go that exceeds the what they could actually spend, would they actually be able to spend it as their as below their? You understand what I'm getting? I don't know how to articulate it very well.
Yeah, you're
maybe
saying,
I'm missing a
you're
principle.
You're saying ask for more than you're able to
spend,
and as your amount of money coming in declines, you would be able to collect that.
Yeah. Is there?
That, I don't think that's allowable under the local option measure.
My understanding that whether you could spend more than
no.
Can you spend less than what you would be entitled to receive?
Can you tax more than what you're entitled to spend today, but as you fall further below the measure 5 or measure 5 cap, I guess, because of measure 50, can you then utilize the authority, the spending authority you created through your local option? I'm not sure I'm not connecting some dots. But
I don't think you can ask for more than what's in the gap or 10% or $500, whichever is less, whatever is the lowest of those amounts.
Won't that change over time as circumstances in your school district and your local tax revenue generating system change? And so would you have if in 2 years later you actually could spend more, would you have to go out and do another local option measure, or can you pass a measure that exceeds what you're allowed to spend, but the state law would still prevent you from spending it, but later you wouldn't have to go back to a second local option? And I'm not articulating this correctly.
I think we understand the question, Paul.
All right, the legislation, suppose you come up with, you impose a local option for 5 years. Right? And when you start out, you are under the 10% of the $500 amounts. Okay? And then something happens so that your levy starts to exceed the 10% or the $500, so that you're actually getting more than what you thought you would, or what you want, really, because you don't want to exceed, there's no incentive to exceed those limits.
Right.
The legislation allows you to adjust downward what you're requesting for the levies so that you don't exceed the 10% of the $500.
Mm-hmm.
So districts will, if they're going to go for several years, they'll want to, and they're close to those limits, they'll want to check to make sure they don't exceed them. If they think they will, they can say, no, we don't want our $1 million this year. We only want $900,000, so that we stay under those limits.
Did I answer your question, Representative?
Well, I think you were looking at it the opposite way. I'm looking at,
there's no spending limit. If you're staying within the gap and you're getting so much money, there's no spending limit on that amount. That's where I'm getting confused in terms of how the spending side comes in.
It's how much you collect, and you cannot collect more than the gap. So there may be some uncertainty in terms of schools for budget purposes, because they're going to go in and anticipate how much this is going to raise for them, and it may turn out to be not correct because of what happens in terms of the size of the gap.
Mm-hmm.
So but they cannot collect more than the size of the gap. Now, are you saying can they collect more in 1 year and then spend it?
Can they ask for authority to collect more later? Can they ask for, rather than trying to adjust their local option every 3 years or 5 years, can they ask for more now?
They're limited duration anyway.
Was it 5 year?
5 year for operations, 10 for capital.
Okay.
If they wanted $1 million the first year, $2 million the second, $3 million the third, I think they can structure it that way. But it's a fixed dollar amount for each of those years.
I guess I didn't realize it was limited. Well, that's just addressed. I think they just would have to go back and readjust their local option request.
But I think the answer to your question is no, they can't do that with $1 amount and ask for more than they can collect and have that be backfilling
back,
in the
yes.
future.
Mm-hmm.
They can't do that.
Yeah.
This just tries to show it in the graph form where it's the lower of the three, so that currently for most school districts, the gap is the smaller amount. And so that would be the amount that could be collected and would be excluded from local revenue in the formula. As the gap grows over time and as districts perhaps try to make use of the gap more in the future, it's likely that the $500 limit will come into play more often in the future. The 10% of local revenue is just under $500 now for most districts. So as the state school fund grows and there's more funding for local districts, that 10% will probably be more than $500 in a few years. And so eventually I see the $500 per student as being the limit that actually comes into play for almost all districts.
Practical purpose.
And that's it.
Okay. Any questions for Steve? Any more questions? Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Paul, do you want to just give us a brief overview of the tax incidence group?
Chair, we did pass out a couple of things in the break. One was on cigarette tax revenue that Dick put together for you that basically shows what we had talked about, that as the price increases go through the tobacco settlement, that translates into less consumption, and that means less in terms of our 68 cents per pack. And that's the latest revenue forecast. So that just shows you that trend is going to affect other revenue. Mr. Chair, the Tax Incidence Project, and I see our chair is missing. But,
and our proponent of the legislation.
I have just got back from talking to the Education Subcommittee of the E-Board, and they have authorized our request to release $150,000, which is half of the $300,000 set aside for the Tax Incidence Project. This was part of Senate Bill 5511, which was the budget reconciliation bill. Essentially, it was a single line on it that said $300,000 available to the Legislative Revenue Office for purposes of building a tax incidence model. So we've been involved in that process, and what we've done is a couple of things. We have agreed on a structure and set that process up, and really on the second page of your handout, you can see the structure we're working within. We've established two committees. One is a Tax Incidence Project Oversight Committee. Representative Witt is the chair of that. It also has Representative King on it. Senator Beyer and Senator Nelson are also on that committee. And then the other membership is in your packet, too. It's a committee that has four members and then four non-members, four lay members on it. So we think that'll give us some good oversight for the project itself. We also have a what we call a model review group that gives us some technical insight on issues that come up. Those committees have met, and our oversight committee did agree on our objectives there on the first page. And really, we wrestled with this a little bit because they're part of the same modeling exercise, but they are distinct. The first one is what I call a traditional incidence model, which would look at the overall distribution of taxes and the ultimate burden. And really, the rationale behind this, kind of the genesis of this idea of the project, grew out of the Governor's Tax Review Committee, which was done last interim, and they recommended a tax incidence study. This is the a group headed by John Mitchell, the U.S. Bank chief economist. And one of the primary concerns was this issue of business household tax burdens and that they are indeed changing in Oregon. But what an incidence model does is take that issue a step further and gets at the ultimate burden, because we know that it's individuals who bear tax burden in some capacity. It may be as a worker. It may be as a stockholder. It may be as a consumer. So a tax incidence model will allow us to get at that ultimate burden and then look at the distribution of the tax burden. For example, you could look at the master settlement agreement as an excise tax increase. That's most of that is that tax is paid by the tobacco companies, but really the ultimate burden is on the smokers. That's an incidence question. We have, I think, a very good model to follow for that first objective, the Minnesota's tax incidence study. And we kind of call this objective the Minnesota approach, which looks at a kind of traditional distribution of the burden. The second objective there is the to build capacity to identify and quantify behavioral responses. And this is an issue I'm sure you recall during the session came up in a number of areas. One that I recall specifically was a bill that passed both House and Senate. It was ultimately vetoed by the governor, but it was changing the apportionment formula on the corporate income tax. One of the arguments is this is going to have some secondary effects and some feedback effects or behavioral effects. In other words, going to encourage more investment. Well, we don't have the capacity to really analyze that kind of an issue now. And what this model would do is give us that capacity. What I think we find a lot of times is that, it's one of our later issues on economic development as well. But you get a lot of pretty wild claims about different taxes and how much benefits we're going to get from them. And what we would like to do is have the capacity to use the best economic model, theory, and evidence available to look at some of those proposals and see what those feedbacks are. One of the first things, elements of tax theory is we know what affects people's behavior one way or another. Sometimes it's not very much. It's very small. It has little revenue impact. Sometimes it can be larger. The other issue is the timing of those effects. Is it something we're going to see next biennium, or is it a feedback effect we're going to see 10 years?